The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Hello again, it's Pat Kenny here. We're currently working away behind the scenes in preparation for my new weekend show, which will be coming your way in March. Every Saturday and Sunday at 10 a.m, I'll be covering everything from the latest in current affairs to the best in culture and lots, lots more. And the good news is, to keep you up to date on all we have to offer, you don't have to do a thing. Just make sure you keep following this feed on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. Between now and then, however, I've been looking back at some of the most thought-provoking and engaging guests to grace our studio over the past 12 years. Now, life in acting started when he netted the role of the third shepherd in the school nativity play, with enormous roles in Downton Abbey and Paddington Bear to follow. Hugh Bonneville's memoir, Playing Under the Piano, is a witty and interesting window into the life and times of one of Britain's most accomplished actors. And Hugh joins me now. Good morning, Hugh.
Thank you for having me on.
This is a wonderful memoir. I was thinking of The Moon's a Balloon by David Niven when I was trying to find some reference point for it.
Well, I'm very flattered by that comparison, my goodness me. That was one of the first memoirs I remember reading in my teens and being absolutely bewitched by it. So if I can capture, you know, one teenager, that would be great.
It's so funny. I mean, it is laugh out loud. It's some of the episodes when you're talking about the joys of reading through a script beforehand or having to change in a lavatory.
Before an audition.
I mean, it's you're wickedly funny. That's something I did not expect.
Oh well, I'm glad about that too. That if I've come across as rather po-faced and serious, it's nice to reveal a little behind the curtain. I think also in writing this, I just wanted to burst a few bubbles that, you know, people think acting is perhaps. You have preconceptions about what actors and acting is like. And so to reveal that sometimes you do get changed in a toilet is before an audition is hopefully a bit of a tip of the trade.
Now, your background is very interesting because on one level, it is absolutely a typical middle class English background. You've got a brother and a sister. And you are the baby of the family, yeah. And always kind of being overshadowed by them in your youth.
That's true. I don't think in a conscious way by them, but I was 6 years younger than my sister, and there was a 2-year gap between Claire and my brother Nigel. I felt not lonely, but I was an only. I felt like an only child a lot of the time, which is why I think I resorted to the dressing up box and had imaginary friends, but I made the friends in my street come and
dress up. Who would be playing football and rough and tumble, you persuaded them somehow to dress up and be your foils.
Well, that's pretty much right. I agreed to play their silly game called football, as long as they would come then and do the serious stuff, which was the acting in the plays that I devised and wrote and directed, and of course played the leading role in, and they could be the sort of courtiers in the background.
Now, there was one moment of revelation when you went to see your sister in a school play.
Yes, and my sister, who I aged 7 or so, I absolutely loathed, and she, you know, she really needed to die.
I mean, you had planned to kill her.
I had planned to kill her. I even dug a shallow grave in the back garden. I'd said to Mum, I've had it, I'm going to dig a grave for Claire. And she said, right you are, dear, you know, tea's at 6. And so I went off and dug this terrible shallow grave. I then went to see her in a play at her school, and she was hilarious. And I thought, my annoying sister's really, really good. There's something about this acting lark, you know.
Now, she made everybody laugh in a way that she would not have done at normal play. And that's when you realise the play is the thing, the script.
The script is everything. And I owe a great debt to my late brother because his LP collection was not only Woodstock and Melanie and, the great sort of 60s sounds, but also he loved Tom Lehrer, he loved Bob Newhart, he loved the Goons, Beyond the Fringe and all that sort of stuff, all the comedy stuff that was on LPs in those days. So I grew up listening to that and realizing, and he kept, you know, saying to me, it's all in the script. If it's not in the script, you can't play it.
Now, your father was an eminent medical man. Your mother was a classic housewife who could do all the housewifely things except, and this is where maybe the acting comes from, she fooled you for years, did she not?
Well, yes, when I was about 10, she announced that she was going to go and take a job in the Foreign Office in London, and a clerk's job, doing some filing, as she called it. And of course, immediately I started slamming doors and crying, because how dare she leave me? Why wouldn't she be there at the end of my school day? And you know, this was utterly selfish of her. Anyway, so for about 10 years, she went and did 3 days a week in this filing. Office block, filing. And then only many, many years later, after she'd retired and my dad had retired, I opened the evening paper one day, and there was a picture of her office block, and it said...
Because you'd gone to drop her off.
Yeah, so occasionally I'd go with Dad in the school holidays. I'd go on his medical rounds with him. He was a surgeon in London. And we'd drop Mum off at work, and, you know, we'd go about our business. And then I opened the paper one day, and it said MI6 building to be sold. And I did a double take, and this was Century House in Lambeth North. And I rang her up, and I said, you used to work at Century House. She said, yes, dear. I said, but that's MI6. He said, yes, dear. And of course, she never divulged anything further.
She couldn't. She'd have had to kill you.
Well, yeah, I know. Yeah, it would have got very James Bond.
But you did find out a little bit more about the mission that she had in MI6, subsequent to her death.
Yes, it was a very strange and rather lovely tale, actually, because I mentioned this on Desert Island Discs, the Radio 4 programme, and... a few days later, I got a message from Riverhouse, the new building of MI6, from a guy there who said, look, we're having these lunchtime talks with people from the outside to come in and just talk about people who've inspired them, etc. Would you like to do that? So I thought, why not? So I went along and went into a lecture theatre full of, 125 boys and girls who were all eating their sandwiches and drinking their cups of coffee or doing the crossword as I talked. And a chap came up to me afterwards who was a bit younger than me, and he said, I worked with your mum. And of course, she'd passed away a few years before. So this was a sudden revelation. A, I'd never known that she did this job or worked in this environment. And then to meet someone who she'd actually worked with. And he said, I was starting out, I was about 18, 20, and we were in whatever section it was called, P section, I think it was. And we'd be doing the, lying around, doing the crossword, whatever. And suddenly we'd hear these footsteps on the corridor going, go on, quick, that's Pat, quick, look, jump to it. And I knew what he meant about those footsteps. And it was the memory of a sound that connected me and him, because when she was on a mission for something, when she was on, whether it was walking to the down the, the village street to get to the church hall for the, to do the flowers, her gait doubled, and I could hear there was an efficiency in her stride, and I'd forgotten that. And to have this chap who I'd never met before reconnect me with my mother in that way was so touching.
And then, of course, you said, well, you were filing as well, were you not?
Well, yes. And I said, so she said she just did some filing, and he said, well, yeah, you could put it like that. She was handling quite sensitive overnight intercepts and, getting them all in the right order so that when upstairs said what's happening in this country or with that asset, we could put our hands on it straight away. So yes, she was filing, but it was of quite a sensitive nature.
Now, a few Irish connections in the book, including playing in O'Casey, Juno and the Paycock, but also your heritage, Howth in County Dublin.
Absolutely. And my mother's father was from Howth. He was one of 12, a family called Freeman. And he joined the RAF, actually, as a doctor back in, between the wars. And so I've got, I think, quite a few relatives who've spread out across the country in some way, shape or form here. But I think a lot went to Canada. So I've been, funnily enough, there's an ITV program in the UK called My DNA Journey. Mm-hmm. And I've recently done that with John Bishop. And both our family roots brought us to Dublin. So that'll be coming out on the TV next year. And it's quite fascinating. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. John being a Liverpudlian, you might expect that.
Well, absolutely. And he knew that he had some strong Irish roots. But I won't spoil it because it's a fascinating... we were both blown away by what we discovered.
Now, you were playing the thespian in school, school plays as much as you could, acting against type on occasion, it would appear physically. Type I'm talking about. But when you decided that you were going to be, well, try to make a life of acting, what did your parents say to you about that course?
Well, I was the last of the three to flee the nest or fly the nest. So they, I think, felt a little bit of pressure off. And so there was a little bit more freedom. And I often think, you know, would my brother, my late brother, and indeed my sister, would they have liked to do it professionally? I think my brother might have done, but he was the eldest and there was no option. He had to sort of get a proper job. It was too risky with two other, you know, little chicks in the nest. And so they were far more lenient with me. And I, in my second year at university, I'd started to hear about drama schools and things like that. This, as I say, was a world I'd no connection with at all, apart from my love of performing in plays. And I said to Mum one afternoon when I was back home from college, you know, I'd just love to give it a go because I had every intention of being a lawyer. I thought that's what I was going to do after university. And I said, I'd love just to try it for a couple of years. And if I fail, then I'd go and get a proper job. And to my amazement and relief, she said, well, we've seen you do enough plays and we're right behind you, you know. Okay. And so they were incredibly supportive.
She probably thought, well, if he has a go at acting, he'll be a great barrister when the time comes.
Well, that probably was also going through their mind. But, you know, I wasn't sort of crazy about it insofar as I said, look, I'm going to give myself 3 years to get my equity card. And if I don't, then I'll go and get a proper job.
Being a member myself of both the NUJ and Irish Actors Equity, I know the catch-22 of the equity card. You can have an equity card as long as you've got, some performances to your credit, and you can't perform until you have an equity card.
It's a crazy situation, or was back then. I mean, you don't need that union ticket now, but certainly in the UK. But back then, yes, you had to either have done a number of sort of cabaret turns and, you know, eight or 10 contracts under your belt, and then you could get a provisional equity card, a proper equity card, or the various rep theatres around the country had two to give away each year. And I remember, and I'm often giving this advice to young people, we did have one connection in the business, and she was an agent's assistant. And I went to speak to her and I said, look, I've got a choice. I'm very lucky. I've been offered an equity card with a theatre in education company, which is basically driving around England doing Shakespeare out of the back of a Vauxhall Astra in schools. Or I've been offered an equity card at the Open Air Theatre in Regent's Park, where I'd be understudying and stuff. And she said, I have absolutely no doubt what you should do is you should join the Theatre in Education Company because you will learn your craft by working with children and et cetera, et cetera. I said, thank you so much. And, you know, she's had 30 years experience in the business. Yeah. So I did exactly the opposite. and I went and held a spear at Regent's Park. And, you know, so I always say to young people, listen to advice, but you've got to follow your instinct ultimately as a performer because you're a self-employed person.
Now, so many experiences early on in theatre, but no movies, no film. And you had this thing, AMF.
AMFF, after my first film.
After my first film and what you would do.
Lots to do. Give me the sunshine, give me a do. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain dew. So give me my good friends, give me a do.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew!
How did the first film come along and how big a part did you have?
Well, AMFF was a family joke that, you know, obviously once I did a movie, I'd have money to burn and I'd, you know, buy a Lamborghini or something like this. Obviously not the case. But MFF, my first film, was in Kenneth Branagh's production of Frankenstein. And I'd been doing his Hamlet. He'd done several productions of Hamlet, but this was his one at the Royal Shakespeare Company and I played Laertes. So we obviously got to know each other pretty well, particularly we had fight rehearsals every day and we'd chat away just before we, went on guard.
And there's another story, which we won't tell here, about your the dry runs running up to the performance. You became ill.
Yes, when I ended up having
the tooth.
Yes, in the third preview, when we were playing to a packed house, I suddenly had to go off to the hospital because I had a bad tooth. Luckily, Laertes, in a full-length production, has about 2 hours off in the middle of the play, and I was able to get my tooth looked at before the end of the show. But during this run, I was an aspiring screenwriter at the time and dabbled a bit. And so Ken said, and I said I'd never been on a film set, and he said, well, look, why don't you, I'll get you a small part in Frankenstein and you can come and learn the ropes a bit and just see how a film works and all that. So he was incredibly generous to me. And I got to have one line in MFF, in my first film, in Frankenstein.
I mean, you describe him as indefatigable, doing three or four projects at the one time. Mm. And an astonishing actor, I mean, you mentioned that he upped a gear or two for the real performance and changed it utterly.
Well, it was extraordinary. When we were rehearsing the Hamlet, he was in post-production on his wonderful film of Much Ado About Nothing. He was in pre-production for Frankenstein. So at weekends, once we were up and running, he literally would get on Concorde and go over to New York, and because he was trying to woo Robert De Niro to play the creature. And then we'd be back on a Monday night and we'd be in the rehearsal room doing our sword fight. He was extraordinary.
In the film, though, I mean, you actually played Robert De Niro's leg.
Well, yes, I always say that. because in the story, in the film, Robert De Niro starts out as a vagrant who has one leg and a wooden leg. And in the story, I'm one of the students, medical students, and I die of the cholera that is inflicted upon the town. And so when the vagrant of De Niro gets lynched, Dr. Frankenstein cuts him down from the noose and lays him out and comes and saws off my leg from the mortuary and sews it onto the creature. Hence, I played a quarter of Robert De Niro.
There are so many details in this book about the things that you pick up as you go along. I mean, one of, I suppose, the rules of thumb, doing the actual shooting is great fun, but it's the 1 hour, the 11 hours hanging around, that is the tedious bit of filmmaking.
Yes, it's that old thing of, you know, you're called at, 7 or 8 in the morning and get all togged up, and then it's hurry up and wait, really, because you are constantly on the, in the sort of starter's blocks all day. There was one particular story I remember of being in Notting Hill, and it was my first, you know, proper decent part in a movie. And I had this scene with Julia Roberts when my character fails to recognize her as the most famous film star in the world. And it's a beautiful scene, beautifully written scene. And we were due to film it on a Wednesday afternoon. And I was just on tenterhooks all afternoon. And then we got to sort of 6 o'clock and they said, oh, we're not going to get to your scene. So, you know, you can wrap now. So all that adrenaline that's been building up, you know, and I remember sleeping incredibly deeply and yet frenetically that night because I thought, well, we still haven't shot the scene. And then we came in the next day and did shoot it. So there's always that energy level that you have to, you know, be able to turn it on.
And then, of course, Four Weddings and a Funeral, which preceded that, you were almost in that.
Well, yes, I had a very long and like so many others of my generation, we had long, tortuous auditions with Mike Newell, a wonderful director, who really gave great audition, but didn't give me the part ultimately. But Notting Hill, it came good.
But then your prediction was, well, it's the same as Four Weddings and a Funeral. This is not going to do particularly well.
Well, when I read the script of Notting Hill, that's exactly what I thought. It's the same plot. It's just slightly, you know, the characters are pretty much the same. They just changed their names.
We have to talk about Downton and Lord Grantham and how that evolved. I mean, it was a time when costume drama, period drama, was not particularly hot, shall we say, internationally, and yet it became a massive hit.
Yes, it was so unpredictable how that, no one could have foreseen the success that it became. And indeed, when we finished shooting the first season, we couldn't get arrested in terms of media coverage because I think a lot of your colleagues would say, oh, you know, we've seen costume dramas, we're not going to interview another actor about another blooming, bonnets and corsets show. And something extraordinary happened with that production. The first episode went out in the UK, and normally the ratings drop off inevitably, even with a successful show, because all the marketing energy has been on that first episode. But our ratings went up in episode two, which is almost unheard of.
So it's word of mouth.
Word of mouth, I think, and people got latched onto it. And suddenly there was people saying, please come on our show and talk about it, because all our listeners or our viewers are really into it. And it grew and grew from there.
Now, it is upstairs, downstairs. You know, it's revisiting that kind of genre. Mm. And superficially, it's incredibly posh. But in fact, it's written like a soap.
Mm. Well, I mean, the producers had first pitched it as Merchant Ivory meets The West Wing, i.e. that sort of walk and talk energy, but with the luxuriant sort of look and feel of a Merchant Ivory film. And Julian Fellowes, is a huge fan of Coronation Street. So that soap element in terms of the characters and the brevity of the scenes, coupled with a sort of more grand landscape and beautiful setting, made it, I suppose, unique at the time.
Hugh Bonneville is with me, a.k.a. Lord Grantham from Downton Abbey. We're talking about his memoir, Playing Under the Piano, and more after this.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Hugh Bonneville is with me. We're talking about his memoir, Playing Under the Piano. Now, it's such an education to the ordinary reader about, for example, when you're shooting a scene that involves food, the real logic is don't eat anything if you can possibly avoid it.
Well, that's right. I think Maggie Smith ate one green bean in a decade, you know, because it's all down to continuity. Because if you take a mouthful on the wide shot, then you've got to take a mouthful on every other angle that the camera's on you. So we all learned to be to push things around the plate a bit.
And how professional people can be. You tell a story about Lily James, and she is to serve herself from the salver onto a plate. But the plate ain't there.
Yes, the plate hadn't been replaced since the last take, and she was such a pro, she just ladled it onto the table mat in front of her.
One of the things about being an actor is insecurity. I mean, it's the name of the game. You're only as good as your last show or your last movie or whatever it might be. Terrible insecurities. But then Downton comes along. Does that free you in a way?
Well, no, I mean, I had been working for 25 years before Downton came along, so it
pretty much non-stop, you say.
Yeah, I've been very, very fortunate. And also, I have something of a workaholic ethic, I suppose, that, I feel so lucky to do something I enjoy, and I'm aware of how fortunate I am and how competitive a business it is. But Downton, yes, it certainly opened doors, put it that way, in a way that so did Notting Hill. You know, I'm no better or worse actor than the day before Notting Hill came out, but suddenly you are more marketable because you're in a product that is doing well. And the same is true of Downton. I wouldn't have met a bear called Paddington without Downton Abbey, I'm sure, or indeed did a film with George Clooney, The Monuments Men. So it's been, it was true for all of us that we were very, very fortunate to be in something that was so beloved. Mm. And helped us get more work, I suppose.
But does it help you to say no?
Certainly, because that is the only power the actor has, really, ultimately, is the power to say no. You can't say, actually, yes, I think I will play Hamlet next year at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Well, unless you're Kenneth Branagh. But, you are so used to being told no as an actor. That is sort of part of the thick skin you have to develop, the rejection of it all. I always think of the opening of Tootsie when you see Dustin Hoffman as an off-Broadway actor just trying again and again at auditions. And he says, look, I can be taller, I can be shorter. And the voice from the stalls at this audition says, we just want somebody else. and you have to take that on board.
But it's so bruising, isn't it?
It is bruising, but you do develop a thick hide about it. But there's always a little needle that gets through, like, why is he better than me for this role? But it's just about chemistry, ultimately. So the power to say no is a great gift, and I'm very privileged now to be brought projects sometimes at an incredibly early stage, even before they've become a script, and to talk about projects in a whole new way.
You are still starstruck yourself, though.
Oh, completely. Goodness me, yes. I do. But obviously, after you've started working with someone, you realize very quickly that they wear underpants too. Well, some don't, but you know what I mean. But I do get starstruck. I get starstruck by talent, full stop. I remember meeting a man who invented the bimetallic strip in kettles. He happened to be at my old college at Cambridge years before me, and obviously became a very rich man because of it. But to meet someone who had talent in engineering like that, and he himself had been inspired by the Hunt for Longitude back in the day. I don't know if you remember that, but under Charles II that they were trying to work out, they could work out latitude, but for navigation, longitude was very difficult because clocks didn't keep time in different parts of the globe as the ships travelled. But by inventing the bimetallic strip, which would expand or contract, you could actually keep a clock keeping measured time, and therefore they could start to define longitude or measure longitude. And this stuck with this chap, Dr. Taylor, and he then employed it in the kettle. It sounds such a simple thing, but it obviously revolutionized the way we all live. So when I met him, I was completely starstruck.
There's one final area I wanted to talk to you about, and that is, access all areas. No matter where you're from, what your accent is, what your ethnicity is, and, that any kid should be able to go to maybe drama school and so on. And yet, when you went, you came across kids who'd never had a book in the house or gone to an actual play.
Mm. Well, this is why I think, in retrospect, when I wrote the book, I think weaving my parents' influence on me through it is now becoming more and more clear to me, because the amount of gratitude I owe them for giving me and my brother and sister a sort of low-level cultural hum in the background of our lives. They weren't highfalutin at all, but they took us to plays. They took us to, goodness me, any number of country houses, which, you know, bored the what's it out of me as a kid, but and looking at all these, you know, pictures and concerts and all sorts of things like that. But it was just there in the background as part of my everyday life, just as normal to mum and dad, like dad playing squash or mum doing the church flowers. And as I got older and I went to the National Youth Theatre, where I started to meet young people from all over the country from completely different backgrounds to me, and I realised how lucky I was to have that exposure to the arts, to the creative, you know, world. And as you say, I was, you know, hanging out with kids who may not have had a book in the house or been to a play, you know, up until them joining the youth theatre. So I'm really passionate now, because I think the arts are vital in education, and in certainly in the UK they've been sidelined increasingly, so that, you know, there's the focus is now on just the core subjects. Yeah. I remember visiting a school, and I talk about it in the book, a school in the southeast. Brand new school, so it had every excuse to have wonderful facilities. It had nowhere for creative expression. There was no music in the school whatsoever, not even the chance to learn an instrument. And I think that's bordering on criminal.
Someone had to design that school.
Well, they did, and they had to design the curriculum too. And so there was not even an after-school club for music. There was painting and stuff, but not for other creative arts. And I think the creative arts are what sets us apart from the beasts. And they allow us to communicate better. They allow us to express ourselves. And I think that's so important.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. What would you say to a parent of a kid who really wants to do it?
I think it has to be a need. It has to be a compulsion. And I often say to young students, if you're dabbling with a choice of maybe being, let's say, a journalist or a lawyer or an actor, if you think there's maybe a choice there, do the other two, because the acting has to be a compulsion. In the same way that when people say you're going to retire, I say, well, that's like asking a painter to stop painting. It's just in me. And I think any young person who has that need and that desire to express themselves in whatever form, then follow your instinct.
Follow your instinct.
Listen to advice, but follow your instinct.
And of course, put yourself in the way of Lady Luck. If you're not there, it's not going to happen.
I think that's very true, and that's something I learned early on. I remember reading Simon Callow's wonderful book about him starting out and his early journeys, and he worked in the box office at the Old Vic. And I think he said, you know, by putting yourself in the environment in which you want to work, you've got a better chance of something, some Lady Luck happening somehow, than if you're working in a, you know, carpet factory in Kidderminster.
Yeah. Osmosis.
Osmosis, yeah, learning by osmosis. Yeah.
Playing Under the Piano is the title of the book, From Downton to Darkest Peru is its subtitle. Its author, Hugh Bonneville, is with me now. Hugh, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.